Our next argument is United Access Technology versus AT&T, SBC, Century, Tel, K-West, 2021, 2002, and 2007. Mr. Gaza, and you might want to first direct your attention to the Robinson-Reeder case.
May it please the court. The reasoning of the D.C. Circuit in the Robinson-Reeder case does not affect declaratory judgment claims such as are at issue here. In that case, the D.C. Circuit found that Rule 54 gave the district court the power to determine whether to maintain jurisdiction over related claims after partial dismissal, and that the litigant's use of the voluntary dismissal procedures of Rule 41 usurped that authority from the district court. But declaratory judgment claims were not at issue in Robinson-Reeder, and they're different. As this court found in the 2007 case of Benetech Australia versus Neutronix, the site is 495 F3rd 1340, the party seeking to maintain a declaratory judgment jurisdiction has an ongoing evidentiary burden to show a substantial controversy of sufficient immediacy and reality to justify a declaratory judgment, both at the inception of litigation and throughout the litigation. Here, when the parties have agreed to dismiss the case, the parties have abandoned this evidentiary burden, and the district court cannot carry this burden without the help of the parties. So unlike in Robinson-Reeder, here, the party's use of Rule 41 does not usurp the district court's authority, because the district court could not maintain jurisdiction without the participation of the parties.
Are you suggesting that in a situation in which if the parties had gone to the district court and asked for a Rule 54B certification, and the district court had said no, as Judge Jordan indicated he probably would have, that nonetheless, even in the absence of the district court's failure to certify under 54B, that this court would have jurisdiction over the summary judgment grant?
So it's a strange result, but I think so. And the reason is, you can picture how it could
wouldn't
go out.
Wouldn't it be easier for you just to dismiss the CenturyTel case at this point? You still have the AT&T case. I don't think anybody's, other than the fact that there wasn't final judgment on a separate piece of paper, but that can be gotten around. But it seems to me you have a big problem with the CenturyTel case, notwithstanding the argument you're making about the declaratory judgment. I've never seen that argument made in the context of a finality determination before.
I agree, and you are correct. This argument has not been made before, but it falls from the Federal Circuit's requirement that there be an evidentiary basis for declaratory judgment jurisdiction. Declaratory judgments are special in that regard. So the district court can't maintain jurisdiction without the presence of the parties. It's impossible under Federal Circuit precedent.
Well, let's assume we reject that argument. Do you have another argument?
No, Your Honor. I think the only other argument I would make is that patent cases are different than Title VII and defamation cases. There is a presumption against piecemeal litigation, especially when you have claims as related as infringement and invalidity where you share the same patent. It makes sense for the jury to consider the issues at the same time.
You think the Supreme Court agrees that patent cases are different?
Depends on the case. I'll move to the merits. The record here shows three ways in which the lines running downstream from the DSLAM are different than the lines that run upstream to the public switch telephone network. First, each twisted wire pair running downstream from the DSLAM transmits signals to exactly one subscriber. There's no switching equipment downstream of the DSLAM. The signals can't jump from one line to another. The destinations are predetermined. In contrast, the upstream voice signals can run to any subscriber on the public switch telephone network through the switching equipment at the central office. Second, starting again with the downstream side, a single twisted wire pair is sufficient to carry the signals that branch to the individual subscribers. In contrast, the defendants have installed higher capacity T1 and fiber optic cables to transmit the voice signals to the switching equipment at the central office. Finally, the downstream lines have a different type of signal. There's a multiplexed voice and data signal that cannot reach the public switch telephone network. The DSLAM is the boundary. The DSLAM takes apart that signal and only allows the voice signals to pass the public switch telephone network. The jury can look at these factual differences between the downstream lines and the upstream lines to determine that these lines should be characterized differently and the boundary should be the DSLAM. For example, the jury can look at the twisted wire pairs coming downstream from the DSLAM and decide that those are branches that lead to individual subscribers and not a trunk that can lead to any subscriber attached to the public switch telephone network. Further, the jury can look at the DSLAM as a boundary because the multiplex voice and data signals, if they try to run up against it, they are taken apart.
But you could have numerous different boundaries, I suppose, between the central office and the signal interface, where you make various changes either in the mode of transmission, the degree to which the wires are bundled. Part of it could be fiber optic, part of it could be wire. You wouldn't suggest that you could put the DSLAM on, let's say, a place upstream of the any number of these convergence points, and that it, because it's a DSLAM, that's enough to mean that everything downstream of that DSLAM is local, as we use the term, versus public trunk.
I disagree. First, from UAT2, of course, the DSLAM can't be open and operated from the central office. That's law of the case. There is a positional limitation for the DSLAM. We know it has to be downstream of a public trunk line. And importantly here, in this motion, defendants have not challenged our designation of the lines running upstream from the DSLAM as a public trunk line. The summary judgment motion is about whether the jury can look at the lines running downstream of the public trunk line and decide that they are extended pairs and not part of the public trunk. There are two other issues we would like the court to address. The first is claim construction. The district court did find that the signal interface must be located at the furthest downstream point of convergence. We think that ruling is an error. Without a ruling that further narrows the positional limitation from the UAT2 case, there's no basis to grant defendant's motion. There's no legal basis that would prevent the signal interface from sitting from where it sits in the accused embodiments. The second issue relates to Dr. Williams' deposition testimony. The district court gave that testimony too much weight. When there is competing expert statements and record factual evidence, the district court should not have taken the admissions and treated them as determinative.
In your brief, you characterized, I think this is a fair characterization, that Dr. Williams's testimony as having been the product of confusion. And I read through the section of his testimony in which he conceded that he had not given an opinion on each of the questions he was asked, which were essentially the same question over and over. I didn't find a source of confusion there. It seemed to me the questions were pretty clear. What is the confusion you see in that sequence of questions and answers?
So I certainly did not intend to give you that impression with my brief. I
thought there was something that basically said in a...
In the heat of the deposition.
In the heat of the deposition, yeah. And it was...
No, it was
a suggestion of a lack of clarity.
Well, right? I agree once a witness has answered a question incorrectly. If you ask the same follow-up question five times, you'll probably get the same answer five times. We do hope that the witnesses maintain a consistent line of argument.
Well, but if on the second question he realizes that he had misapprehended the question the first time, you would expect a different answer with an explanation.
Hopefully.
We didn't get that.
Correct. But on summary judgment, we can't compare the expert's deposition answers and prefer them to the statements in his declaration. If we do that, we are we are having a trial by document. We are robbing the jury of its chance to evaluate the credibility of the witness and determine if those questions that he did answer multiple times in a disfavorable way should overtake his statements he had made before the deposition.
What do you think is the strongest statement in any of his expert reports, either of his expert reports, that favors the construction that you're advocating?
So we're not relying on the expert report to justify our claim construction.
No, decisions. I said construction. That's a misstatement. The theory that you're suggesting.
Okay. So, again, we do point to his statements at pages 19 to 21 of the reply and 48 to 50 of the opening brief.
If you would give me the paragraphs of the reports, because that's what I've got in front of me.
Okay. Unfortunately, I did not bring those sites up with
so
me.
But I
will say, in the reply brief at pages 19 to 21, we do cite the three statements that we believe support this, along with the diagram where he literally labels the lines coming downstream from the DSLAM as extended pairs, mm-hmm. and the lines going upstream from the DSLAM as the public trunk line. But in his report, in the portions that we cited to in pages 19 to 21 of the reply, we have three bullet points that are right before the diagram. That's where he explains how he came to his conclusions. If there's no other questions, I would like to save the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
We will do that.
Thank you.
Mr. Hawes.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'll start with the Robinson-Reeder case, and I'll just give one point beyond what my colleague said. I would point out that in Robinson-Reeder, and this is in footnote 7, and also I believe it is in page, we've got two different, using the FedThird site, it's 1340. The case talks about how statute of limitation or any other analogous constraint can be sufficient. And going in further of what my colleague said, I would say that the basis of the counterclaims at issue in the second appeal are an analogous constraint. If we look at them in the record, you'll see that the only basis given for those declaratory judgment counterclaims is the complaint of infringement. So once that complaint of infringement was resolved on summary judgment, this court's affirmance does act to eliminate, in the same way as the statute of limitations, the basis for those counterclaims. Because the only basis given for how the counterclaims, which are declaratory judgment counterclaims, meet the case or controversy requirement was the affirmative infringement assertion that was made in the complaint. So there is language in Robinson-Reeder that lines up with the analysis offered by my colleagues. So I just offer that to the court. But as the court pointed out, we can reach the merits regardless because of the appeal in the 338 case, which had no other claims.
And there would be no prejudice, as far as I can see, to CenturyTel, or at least it's a little hard to see how there would be prejudice, by dismissing their appeal and simply requiring that they go back if AT&T loses the case and UAT wins it. You go back to the district court and you start all over again, right?
Well, Your Honor,
start all over again. You start where you left off.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure what the district court would do at that point. Rule 41 does allow litigants to dismiss without prejudice a claim. And there's nothing left for the district court to do, given that the rule allows the parties to do exactly what they did.
But the problem with it is that what the policy that seems to me emerges clearly from the rule is exactly what Judge Garland said in Robinson-Reeder, which is to have the district court act as the dispatcher of the issue of finality. Yes, you can dismiss. That doesn't necessarily mean you thereby automatically get review in the Court of Appeals, that you have finality for purposes of Section 1291, or in our case, 1295. So there's a difference between what 41A1A2 allows versus what 1291 requires. You'd agree with me on that?
Well, I agree with you that that's what the D.C. Circuit, that's the analysis of the D.C. Circuit. But let me give a little bit. It is odd to say that a district court is constrained to go to trial, right, on the remaining claims when under Rule 41 the parties dismiss a claim. They're allowed to do that. So from a judicial efficiency, it's not like the district court under Congress's structure is allowed to say, well, I'm not going to go to trial on the remaining claims because you used Rule 41 to dismiss this one claim that I think shouldn't have been dismissed. And yet, at the appeal level, that same question of going forward with the remaining claims somehow becomes a bar to appeal. And I don't think that was really considered in the Robinson Reeder case. I don't think this court needs to read it because these counterclaims are different. They're declaratory judgment counterclaims and thus are linked in the language of Robinson Reeder because they have a, in the language, analogous constraint. Mm-hmm. They're linked to the claims that were adjudicated on the merits.
And so just to be clear, and this was your first argument you presented, so because this was a DJ, what? Why does that give us jurisdiction? Because they would your argument is because they would automatically fall if there were an affirmance?
Simply put, Your Honor, affirming ends the case. That's the basis for the final judgment, final decision rule, is we want the affirmance to end the case. In Robinson Reeder, the Title VII claim and the defamation claim were independent claims, right? That there could have been an affirmance, and that plaintiff could have come back and sued the next day for defamation. But if the defendant in this case comes back and makes that same DJ claim the next day, it gets dismissed because the basis for the DJ claim, assuming this court...
So your rule would not apply to what most of our cases are like, where you've got counterclaims.
If the counterclaim is a DJ claim based on an affirmative claim,
right,
it applies. If it's a separate, then no, it wouldn't apply. It's only when, in the words of Robinson Reeder, there is a constraint such that the affirmance will block the subsequent reattempt at that claim. And that's the case here.
Why don't you get to the merits?
Yeah, no, that's right.
So, on the merits, I'd like to start with Judge Bryson's question. You asked my opponent, I think it's a great question, what part of these reports are supposedly in contrast with the crystal clear deposition testimony? So the court below looked at the fact that this court has said there is a requirement that you put forward evidence applying the proper construction to the accused system. That's what the judge below said. And that is what wasn't happening here. And in answer, basically, the plaintiff wants to say, well, we'll just tell the jury about the accused system. No evidence of applying the proper construction to it, and we'll let the jury decide. And in fact, if you look at some of the things they point to, they're pointing at the specification. They're asking the jury to do what the Supreme Court in Markman said is not the jury's job, to look at the specification and decide, well, what's disclosed in the specification, it's kind of close to the accused systems in some way. I mean, that's why we have two parts to infringement. We determine the proper claim construction, and then, as a matter of fact, the patentee has the burden of putting forward evidence applying that claim construction to the accused systems. Here, the only evidence put forward of that was, in theory, the expert, and the expert said, well, I'm not looking at whether this is truly the opposite end, right? The expert went and said, well, I can see that there's public trunk line between the central office and this spot where I say the proper signaling interface is, and then said, and I am not looking any further. I am not doing any analysis of what's downstream.
Well, he said that in his deposition, but do you read the excerpts from his reports as saying essentially that, or do you think he went farther, maybe even a little farther, by way of suggesting that everything downstream of the DSLAM is local?
Respectfully, Your Honor, let's turn. We didn't get an answer as to where in the report, we were told to look at the bullet points on pages 19 and 20, and that'll let me address your question.
Mm-hmm.
So the first bullet point is they basically say, well, he said that the DSLAM sits at the local end of the public trunk line. And therefore, he must have meant that everything downstream, right, is not public trunk line. The problem with that is this court has said many times, starting with Arthur C. Collins, which we cite in our brief, that you can't just give the conclusion and say, the expert said the conclusion, therefore we infer some analysis is behind it. That's not the test. You have to actually have the expert provide some analysis under the claim construction. So that bullet point doesn't do it. The second bullet point is that he states that the bundled lines running between the DSAM and the serving terminal are extended pairs. That's recreating the argument they made on claim construction. Nothing in the claim construction says anything about extended pairs. So the claim, applying the claim construction required him to look at public trunk line, which is what the claim construction says, and determine where the opposite end is, and apply that to the accused systems. But instead, he goes back to the terminology that they argued on claim construction. But claim construction's over. The district court found a claim construction. This court affirmed that claim construction. The burden at that point was for the patentee to put forward evidence applying that claim construction. Arguing about extended pairs, which is not part of the claim construction, was part of their argument about claim construction, doesn't meet that burden. Finally, third bullet point.
Let me ask you just a clarification of nomenclature, really, because different terms are used in different sources for these sets of wires that are going up the stream. I think in the previous decision, I characterized, because I wrote the opinion, characterized more accurately, extended pairs as including what are referred to in this record and other places as not only the extended pairs, i.e. everything from the serving terminal down to the residences, but also the twisted pairs from the serving terminal up to the remote terminal. I take it that that is the more proper nomenclature. Is that right, or is there a different nomenclature that you would even think preferable to that?
I think, Your Honor, looking at your opinion from the previous UAT2 case, I would point you to, this is on page, let me make sure I get that right, 968 of the opinion, where you say the patents make clear that the terms public telephone network and public trunk line refer to a segment of the telephone wiring network located between the local exchange and a point of convergence where the pre-existing interface was located. And then below that, you cite to the specification, and you refer to the interface that is a connection between the extended pairs and the pairs that are part of the trunk line.
Yeah.
So in discussing that, now that's not part of the construction, but in discussing that, the extended pairs are not the pairs that are part of the trunk line. And the only pairs that are part of the trunk line are between the remote terminal and the serving terminal.
And those would be generally referred to, I take it, well, correct me if this is wrong, as twisted pairs as opposed to extended pairs. Is that a fair statement?
Your Honor, I think they're both referred to. They're both twisted pairs. I don't think you can make that generalization.
Okay.
And this is one of the problems with just saying, well, jury, here are some technical documents about this accused system. And you apply the claim construction because our expert isn't going to do it. We're not going to put in evidence applying the claim construction, even though that's a factual issue according to this court's law. We want to just kick it out to the jury, tell the jury about 50-odd columns of patent that we have here, and have the jury make the call. And as you realized in the last opinion, there are figures in this patent that clearly aren't part of these claims. Yeah. That was one of the arguments. And so leaving the jury to just take the patent and compare it to the accused system, when there's no substantial evidence, as the court below found, of applying the proper claim construction to the accused systems is exactly what Rule 56 is supposed to avoid. So looking at that question, I think it's clear that I do want to get to this last bullet point, right? I don't want to leave one open. The bullet point says, finally, this is the last bullet point, page 20 of the reply brief, he concludes that the DSLAM meets the positional limitation of the term signal interface, which would be impossible if the lines running downstream of the DSLAM were part of the public trunk line. So again, the expert set a conclusion, and we're going to infer that there was underlying analysis. That's not, as this court has said many times, the standard. You don't just get to have your expert say the accused system has the limitation and therefore beat summary judgment. Especially in this case, you don't even have to go there under your law, but in this case, the expert said that and then admitted in deposition, but I didn't do the analysis, and I refuse. I don't have an opinion on the analysis that would be required to determine that truly we are at the opposite end of the public trunk line. It's like walking out to I-95 on the Beltway and looking up to Maine and saying, I'm at the opposite end of Maine on I-95, without turning around and looking at I-95 going all the way to Miami. That's essentially what the expert did.
Let me turn your attention to the doctrine of equivalence, if I could.
Yes, sir.
There is a place in Judge Stark's summary judgment opinion in which he says, and I'll just quote it, that for purposes of the motion, the parties provisionally stipulated that a reasonable jury could determine as a factual matter that the locations of the DSLAM in defendants' accused instrumentalities are insubstantially different than that required by the signal interface or telephone exchange claim limitations. What do you make of that stipulation?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not exactly sure about the stipulation, but in terms of the summary judgment briefing that was in front of a judge this time, it was clearly contested. There's no question, if you look at the motion, that that was contested. And I would turn, Your Honor, to, in the appendix, to page 10827 and 828.
So just hold off and sure. On that, if you could keep the thought out. Are you saying, in effect, that for purposes of this motion or the motion, the one that was before Judge Stark does not apply to the current motion before Judge Jordan?
That is certainly our position, okay. Your Honor, and I think the briefing bears that out. And again, if, on page 10827 and 828, that is the entirety of the argument made by UAT as to DOE in front of the court with regard to the current motion. And you'll see that almost all of that goes to the frequency argument, which is the summary judgment motion that the judge didn't even reach below. So there's about four lines going to the issue on which the judge below decided, the signaling interface, and it's an argument that they don't even raise on appeal. They haven't preserved any of their arguments on DOE.
Now, one of the arguments that's made in favor of saying there's no DOE is that the patent suggests that the invention was designed to avoid governmental regulations preventing certain types of signals going on the public trunk. How does your system, if it does, avoid those regulations since you are, by hypothesis, on the public trunk?
So, Your Honor, first of all, the patent is specific and it has to do with amounts of energy. It's not actually signals. So I'll point, Your Honor, to the specifics on that. So we made that argument based on the actual patent, and let me get you to that. That's at 234. And that's column 48, lines 39 to 46.
Right.
And I'm sorry, I am going over time, but I just want to answer your question. And if you look there at those last few lines, lines 44 to 46, you'll see that what was being discussed was the severe limits on the energy that can be conducted onto the network in that particular band. So by minimizing that energy, you are able to achieve compliance with the regulations.
Energy, not frequency.
But that's a totally different invention, right? So they didn't know how to do that. They said, don't try that. We figure out how to do it, and that's why it's not me. Anyway, that's the argument you're on.
Unless
the court has a...
Thank you, Mr. Hawes. Mr. Garza has some rebuttal time.
I have 3 points I'd like to make on rebuttal. First, Dr. Williams' analysis is at the appendix, page 6628, 6629, paragraphs 303 to 305. Now, defendants suggest at this point that this argument is too facile, that there isn't enough development in these three paragraphs to justify the conclusions. Had they argued this at district court under Daubert, you would review that decision as an abuse of discretion. They did not challenge the sufficiency of his reasoning under Daubert. This issue is, you can't review that for the first time here. As a result, you have to take this analysis as evidence that the jury could use on summary judgment. They haven't preserved their Daubert argument. Second, patent cases are not different in one important regard. You don't need an expert to handhold you through the evidence. We have shown in our briefing that there are real factual differences between the lines running downstream from the D-SLAM and the lines running upstream. The jury can look at those and go, I understand these lines are leading to the public switch telephone network and any telephone. These lines aren't. These are only leading to one subscriber. They can look at those factual differences and come to the proper conclusion about the end of a public trunk line. And of course, public trunk line has not been further construed other than saying that it's the public telephone network. Again, because we're on defending summary judgment motion, they have to say what in the construction prevents this from working. What in the construction stops our analysis from satisfying an infringement claim. What they point to is the serving terminal. They point to the serving terminal as the be-all, end-all of what stops this infringement case. And for the reasons in our brief, the construction UAT2 has nothing to do with downstream points of convergences, has nothing to do with downstream bundling, and without a claim construction like that of the district court, they can't satisfy their summary judgment burden. Unless there's any other questions, I'm happy to release the rest of my time.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.